For 35 years, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation has been dedicated to saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to compete on the racetrack from possible neglect, abuse, and slaughter. The oldest and largest charity in the U.S. devoted to racehorses, the TRF makes a promise of lifelong sanctuary to those horses unable to pursue a second athletic career. Unique within the aftercare industry, the horses of the TRF find their second chance in the role of teachers through the TRF Second Chances program, which provides vocational training in 7 correctional facilities across the U.S. The program is Saving Horses and Saving Lives. Learn more at www.trfinc.org, and please use the special In the Money podcast link to donate, trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show 91, almost to that century mark, and well over it if you count all the other stuff we've been doing. It is Thursday, November 21st. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again, getting ready to leave the bunker. Going to do some recording today, some recording tomorrow. Saturday, heading out to Del Mar, going to spend Thanksgiving week out there once again this year. Really, really looking forward to that. Going to be on with Frank Scatoni live from Del Mar on Sunday. If I can figure out the technology, I might even try to post that show as a podcast. We've been promising to answer some questions. We're going to get to some of that today. And joining me to do so, from the planet Texas, he's the people's champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's up?
PTF, what's going on? We've got a lot going on. Obviously, the ABR voting stopped a couple days ago, so that was exciting. A lot of fun to mess around with that stuff. And then a little slow this weekend in terms of the stakes opportunities, but they'll pick back up sooner than later. Next thing you know, it'll be Cigar Mile, and then it'll be Pegasus, and we'll be right back into the Triple Crown Trail. So I always like to take this time of the year to kind of play around with some ideas and kind of do some nice, kind of research and development. I think it's a good time to take a deep breath and take a look at those situations. And then I pop in when there's a carryover or two.
That's a great point about this time of year. A tool like Stats Race Lens, you can really go and do some deep dives and go down rabbit holes and look back at a meet like Saratoga. I'm not currently involved in any research projects, but you maybe look to do that Chad Brown deep dive, look for a weakness there, look at the inner turf versus the outer turf. Do you have any projects? I've got one that relates to one of our questions that I'm going to see if maybe we can get John Camardo working on. But do you have any research projects you're currently working on through Stats Race Lens or any other tools?
Stats I just kind of use on the fly when there's questions I have when I'm looking at a race, when I'm trying to identify, which riders are excelling at the two-turn turf races at Del Mar, things like that. You know, there's a great opportunity to find some hidden secrets where, you know, you might see someone who's winning at a very high percentage that you wouldn't think is winning that high. Someone like a Flavian Pratt, obviously we know that he does well, but there could be other sneaky ones that could pop up on you. So, I like to do those as they come along. I just think there's a lot of things that you can, and the way that Stats works is that it saves those situations for you. So if you do them once, then they're there forever. So that kind of works out too. The only other thing I'm really working on is just trying to get a better understanding for how turf races are run in terms of identifying using the sectionals to identify hidden races that are run well, that either they started off really slow, but they had an exceptional acceleration somewhere in the race that is hidden, I think, by the final figure. It's hidden by pace figures at times because they just come back as looking like they were slow early. And then they can also be hidden by trip. So that's something I'm kind of working on to get a better feel for turf racing and looking at something that I think, a majority of the public doesn't look at.
One area I'd say, if you're just getting started with this, the trainer deep dives are great. And if you go back and just take whatever trainer you feel like researching and go back, one thing you can do is just look at situations where their horses have won and or outrun their odds and go back and look at a series of those past performances, and you'll often find some sort of pattern, some sort of trainer that is able on a somewhat consistent basis to put horses in where maybe on the raw paper they don't fit, but due to some element in the conditioning, they're going to fit in that spot. I think about the Breeders' Cup, and two examples just pop to mind right away of trainers I feel like I trust, especially in graded stakes races. They might put a horse in that on paper looks like they're a little bit behind the rest, and as a result, you get a big price. But thinking back to Sharing again, not to toot our own horn too much, but looking back to Sharing in the juvenile Phillies turf, and this was one who, just on numbers, didn't really, I don't want to say didn't fit, but was a deserving outsider. But then you go back and you look and you see this is Grand Motion, and you look at the times that Grand Motion spots a horse so ambitiously, and you can see why that she fit as well as she did. And then the other great example of this to me in underneath terms, and this one also probably requires that you were paying a little bit of attention to the buzz out at Santa Anita during the week, but looking at Richard Mandela with United in the turf, that was a horse for an underneath key that just made so much sense. Didn't necessarily fit, just looking at the numbers. There was so much else going on in that race, so many other ways to go. But you look at Mandela's pattern in big races, in Breeders' Cup races, of having horses outrun their odds. And you look at this one who looked great in the morning. I had noted in my At the Races column, in the little video we did for Breeders' Cup, United was noted as one that had a very good chance to hit the board. And the other thing I love about doing these exercises at the Breeders' Cup, and I talked about this a little bit with Steve Bick the other day, the Breeders' Cup is so amazing in terms of betting opportunities because of the depth of field. Either of those examples, I feel like if it's just your average race and Grand Motion has a horse that looks a little bit behind the best of them on numbers, or Mandela has one that is behind them on numbers, but in the graded stake race at Del Mar or Saratoga, they're still somehow only 6 or 8 to 1 because everybody's a wise guy and the money only goes to so many different places. But you go to the Breeders' Cup and those numbers just go through the roof. And it's something that I want to think about going forward, JK, is devoting even more of my powder, more of my resources next year to the Breeders' Cup. I almost feel like I should be betting 10 times as much that I do on a normal big day, even on the Breeders' Cup, because I think the opportunities are that good. Do you think that's an exaggeration, or do you think I might be onto something?
No, I think you're onto something. I mean, I think you actually pointed out this summer at Saratoga that it just continuously feels like every time that I was getting beat in a bet, or if we were playing something together, it always seemed to take place in some low level race with cheaper types. I think when it comes to the stakes races and knowing all of the storylines and being familiar with the horses and their stories and how they've ended up where they've ended up, and really almost not even needing the past performances because I know so many things about the horses and their three, like Bricks and Mortar, like for instance, like I can just tell you the story of his last four races. I don't even need to look at the paper. Those are the situations that I think that I've learned I excel in. So I needed to take advantage of those opportunities. I need to take advantage of carryover situations. If I'm going to spend $300 on a pick five that has a carryover, I shouldn't be spending $300 on a pick five, an early pick five with two maiden claimers in it. Mm-hmm. There has to be a discrepancy in between the two, because obviously one is a better opportunity and one I'm better at than the other. So I think just kind of taking a look at your play as a whole can help you find some things like you mentioned, some areas in which you should dedicate more of your bankroll.
Yeah, I allocate capital so inefficiently, and it's something I've said this for, I think I've been saying this for years on this show now, and I think I've gotten a little better, but there's so much work to be done still, and I think one of the best things I could do is just to put more energy into the Breeders' Cup. Let's talk about pick five carryovers for a minute. Did you get involved at the Churchill Downs one last night? I know I feel bad. Apologies to the listeners. JK was the man. He wanted to do an emergency pod on it. I'm underwater trying to get a jump on next week's shows as well, so wasn't able to do it. But did you participate, and did you have any joy?
The first four races, I had some joy. And then I got beat by Wesley Ward in the last race. obviously, you know, hindsight's 20/20. The horse won like Golda Cova out there and won the turn mile. But it was a 3-year-old gelding, homebred for the Ramseys, that didn't make a start for Wesley Ward until October of the 3-year-old year, which is this year. That day, missed the break by 4. So I'm thinking, look, the horse is a gelding. The horse is a homebred. The horse didn't break last time. It's trained by Wesley Ward, going 2 turns. The horse just must not be very good. If Wesley can't get him out of the gate, no one can. Horse pops, gets to the lead, goes 52 to the half, and opens up, like I said, like Golda Cova. It happens.
Were there any workout clues? That's the first thing I think of.
I don't think so. No, I don't think there was. The horse was working at Keeneland. I don't think there was any workout clues, but, you know, I'll do that thing where I talk really slow and double check. But I don't think so. I think that if I remember correctly, yeah. No, I mean, he had some okay works back in the past, and was at Turfway Park last time for the last work. He went 102, went 5 furlongs in 102, and you know, I guess the only clue was he was bet on debut and didn't run very well. But, you know, whatever.
I'd want a reason to think the gate issue was going to be resolved more than just that, I think, in that situation. What price was this runner?
7-2, I think.
Okay. Weak field, I'm guessing.
It wasn't the strongest field in the history of a maiden special weight, but you know, I felt like I was on the two horses that I needed the most that ran second and third. They had both run like 7 times, seven times for one of them, 9 times for the other in a maiden. So it looked like they kind of looked like they were not wanting to get their picture taken. I thought it was more circumstantial. I don't think that's why they got beat. I think this horse just freaked and got an easy lead and, you know, happens.
Production meeting in the middle of the show. So for next week, I already know a little bit about the late week schedule. I think we will try to do an In the Ring show about the Churchill Downs 2-year-old day. So we'll do that late week after, well, we'll see when they draw those races. And then we'll obviously have to plan the whole Turkey Day around it. But we'll do something of that ilk with Sean Tugel. Want to ask him about some of the breeding industry news too and get his take on that, California Chrome, etc. And then the late week proper show is going to be our degenerate gift giving guide. That will drop on Black Friday. I'm very excited about that. At some point, we'll have to squeeze in some talk about the Del Mar Turf Festival because we've got a load of Del Mar graded stakes. I'll be out there. Maybe I'll even do a special show with Frank Scatoni about that if our schedules mesh. I'd love to bring you into the loop. And then early week, I'm going to be on. Maybe I'll grab Frank again and we'll do Redboard Rewind with Spencer talking about those races we're going to be going over on Sunday for Del Mar's card. And then maybe, JK, depending on what your schedule looks like, we could do our interview for this book I'm working on with Matt Miller, the as of yet untitled racing book about most memorable days. Maybe I'll do that interview with you and edit it and post it as a podcast if you're ready to have that conversation and you're not too crazy next week.
No, I mean, I'm going to be still in the Planet Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but I should be able to get on and do a little something.
So it sounds like we'll have pretty much of a full schedule despite the holiday week. And then, as you indicated, the following week, also big stuff. Check out the Naira show for sure. But we'll probably cross-pollinate a little between the Naira show and the regular show because we have all those big races from Aqueduct, the last big graded stakes of the year happening out at the Big A. I heard a rumor Clay Sanders from 10 Strike Racing might be coming to the Big Apple for those, JK. Maybe I'll actually get myself out there. I haven't been to that day in a number of years, but it's always a good time. And that could be a lot of fun. What about you? Any shot of getting you to New York before it's all said and done in 2019, or are you largely Texas-bound?
Small chance for Cigar Mile Day being up there. But yeah, I think I'll probably be plugged into Texas pretty heavy for the next couple of months. We'll see.
Let's get to some of these Ask ITM questions. The first one is related to a research project and the Breeders' Cup, as we were talking about. And this one comes from our buddy Spencer Vandendoel. And he was curious about runners in the same calendar year exiting the Breeders' Cup and then running again. Is there a hangover? He wanted to know. I thought it was an interesting hypothesis, but I feel like there's been plenty of examples of horses doing it with no problem. What's your gut about horses coming back again in the same calendar year who ran in the Breeders' Cup? Are you inclined to bet on, inclined to bet against, or evaluate them each as individual runners?
Yeah, I think that's a real dangerous situation to try to come up with an absolute. I think you want to treat them as individuals. I think you want to see, you know, maybe in stats racelands, you can just see like what a trainer's stats are off of a win. And you can get some idea, even if the horse didn't win in their Breeders' Cup race, the idea is that a trainer had a horse, you know, fully ready to run last time and they won, and how do they run, you know, subsequently off of that effort. I think you can, the same kind of basis can be drawn from Breeders' Cup. They're fully ready to run on Breeders' Cup day, and then now what happened after that? So I think that's maybe one way you can kind of look to get an idea how trainers are going to do that situation. But you know, I wouldn't overthink it. You know, if Spun to Run shows up again soon, you know, what are you going to toss him because he didn't run, you know, because he ran well last time, and why can't he continue to run well? He's a lightly raced 3-year-old and continue to improve. So I would stay away from the absolute there. I would treat them like individuals and really start at the bottom of their PPs and tell a story. You know, if it's Midnight Bisou who comes back, yeah, she's a type you want to maybe fade. She didn't run that great last time. She ran well enough, but she had that really long campaign. Now it seems like a little bit of an afterthought. Are they running again to try to secure a trophy when that might not be the best situation in the grand scheme of things? You know what I mean? So I think that makes a difference.
Those are some good tools I think you gave folks to take a look at, the going through the PPs and looking at them based on themselves, trying to tell the story, understand where they are in their form cycle. And then also the idea of looking at a trainer's stats off a win. I like both those. Spencer had a quick follow-up, actually, specifically about Breeders' Cup juvenile winners. He feels like lately not doing so well at three, citing Newspaper of Record, Jaywalk, and Game Winner, to name a few. And he wonders if you have any concerns about sharing or structure going forward.
No. I don't. Newspaper of Record was a special talent who was very aggressive. And it's not that she didn't train on as a good horse. Her style of aggression didn't work out facing older, more mature horses. And
she was never really distances. She was also never really allowed to be fully aggressive.
That's a great point. Game Winner, I mean, you can't say that he didn't train on, because the race that he ran in the Derby was arguably the best race of the Kentucky Derby. He just got hurt. So I don't think it's like that he didn't train on thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of examples of other horses that did go on to end up being good. And of course, Rushing Fall, obviously. she won the Breeders' Cup and went on to be a good horse. Good Magic went on to be a good horse. Mendelssohn is standing at Coolmore now as a stallion. He went on to be a pretty darn good horse and had some good efforts. So I just think that they're individuals. And I think in racing in general, when you start blanketing things, it can get you into bad situations. And that's kind of, you know, that goes for trainer stats too. You know, 28% off the claim. Oh, I got to use the horse. Well, do you? You know, I just think that any absolute you come up with is problematic.
They can be guidelines for sure, but I don't think you want to always, well, you certainly don't always want to treat them as rules, and getting too dogmatic in this game typically leads to suffering. Specifically in the case of sharing instructor, it's like the sharing edition of the In the Money Players podcast. I feel like their scope for improvement is just immense, because I feel like they've both sort of come and have been good before you necessarily would have thought they would have been good, in the sense that they're winning these Breeders' Cup races while being so carefully handled. So I'm extremely bullish on both sharing instructor and love the idea, have been really, I'm excited, and I hope it comes to fruition, this idea that sharing could be headed to Ascot. Got a handful of interesting USA storylines already, potentially, for this 2020 Ascot meeting, and it's one that we'll be covering more than usual, I think, here with some of the work that it looks like we're going to be doing for Ascot. So we'll follow that story closely. Instructor, as we've discussed, both with Ramiro, who was involved with the picking out the horse, sounds like the future might be on dirt, and I'm really interested to see if he takes to that surface as well. All right, let's move down the question line here, unless you've got anything specific about either of those two runners, JK.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, I think Sherry for sure is going to train on. You know, she's trained by a guy in Graham Motion who can, you know, can get some horses to see out their career. Look at Animal Kingdom. He you know, he had the great three-year-old year, and then he trained on to continue to be a good horse. So I think Sharing's in good hands there. And there's so many things about her that suggest that she's versatile enough that she's going to continue to train on. Like I said, she won that sprint on the dirt. She ran well in a turf sprint. She, you know, won the two-turn Breeders' Cup from an outside post. She's got the pedigree to go longer and to train on, so I'm excited to see her moving forward.
Here's a good one. How is horizontal betting strategy different on big days? What changes do you make to your horizontal betting strategy on big days, JK?
I guess the thing is, on big days with big pools, I'm more inclined to add that extra horse. On smaller days with small pools, that can be dangerous. You can end up upside down on a ticket. But it seems on the bigger days with the bigger pools, seemingly with more dead money in there, you can get away with that late addition, that let me go ahead and use this one as a B type, or let me go ahead and hit it one more time for a little saver here on this horse or whatever it might be. So that's really the only big difference for me when it comes to the Breeders' Cup or the big days is just that ability to kind of hit that extra combination.
I was going to say something similar. Being more inclusive, I think, often makes sense. Mike Maloney talked about this. He wasn't talking about big days, but he was talking about Kentucky Downs. And I think there's a similarity in terms of looking at a meet that has big fields, where in those spread races especially, you can be more inclusive. We're not necessarily talking about including more runners in every leg, but just the general idea of being more inclusive, very much related to that. A note that I wrote down while you were responding: don't be afraid to spend a little bit more money. It gets to that idea I was saying at the top of the show about it being okay to allocate more bankroll on the bigger days. And then the next one, and maybe this is wrong, because maybe this is something you should be doing every day, but realistically, most of us probably can't. Spend more time and creativity thinking about the bets that you're writing. Because again, when we talk about being more inclusive, it's not just put more horses in every leg. That's probably not going to work out. But spend more time thinking about where you're going to want to take your stand, and just more, again, just being more creative, not necessarily just writing out tickets and using ABCX, but maybe trying to find some creative ways of saying, hey, if I'm right about this leg, I'm going to be super spready other places, but then I'm going to have another ticket where I can still have a couple of backups there. But if I do that, then in this race where I'm the second most confident, I'm going to have only one or two, taking sort of an extended version of the Steve Crist Barry Meadow betting structure on those days. But the fact is, it's going to take more time. And I think on the biggest days, it's worth devoting more time to the process of bet writing. And I mean, I think that's most of it. I would also say, and again, this is going to get to your betting personality a little bit, but on the biggest days, I'm usually more inclined to talk to some other people and hear their opinions and let them inform mine. Again, not to get me off what I feel the strongest about. That stuff I want to try to keep as close to in stone as possible. If I think only two horses can win, I don't necessarily want to hear about the fuzzy long shot in there. But for the spread races, again, if I'm using four and somebody who I respect likes a fifth who's 20-1, costs so little to include that horse, I just feel like spending more time on all aspects, but particularly the bet writing, is something you might want to consider when it comes to racing's biggest days. Anything else on this topic, JK?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is, on these big days, I'm more inclined to, or more likely, I guess is probably the right word, to toss a favorite.
That's interesting.
Because you know more about the favorite and the competition. Man, it's hard to toss a 3-5 shot that ran for 50 last time that shows up off a 180-day break for Rudy Rodriguez, right? Like, I mean, everyone's sitting there saying, like, oh, what do I do with this horse? I mean, do I talk? You know, as soon as you toss the horse, he wins by 17. So, because you don't know. You don't know, is it a negative drop? You don't know, is he fit? You don't know, how is he training? You don't know, is he healthy? Are they trying to drop the horse? Are they trying to get rid of him? What, you know, you don't know any of the, you don't know any of those things. But when it comes to a horse like Omaha Beach or Midnight Bisou or McKenzie, you know the story. You've seen the horse work. You know how he got here. You know why he got here or she got here. And you can work through all of those details and make more informed decisions. So I just think that it's easier to be more, try to take more direct hits when you're on the big days, when you're facing horses that you're more familiar with.
Let's move on to the next question. This one has to do with betting strategy as well. Listener Matt Taylor said that he loved a 25-1 shot, ran second and didn't cash any tickets because a horse he didn't like at all ran first, didn't have any place money. Is that a mistake?
No, I think this is not to pivot, but I think that a very important thing that we should probably talk more about, and we talk about it quite a bit, is that, like, horse players are entirely too results oriented, right? I have friends that do it all the time. They call me and say, oh man, I was going to use a 7, but I talked myself out of it. Now I'm so mad. Well, you talked yourself out of it because you didn't like the horse. There's a reason that you didn't like the horse. And yes, maybe you learn something after the fact that will maybe help you, whatever, but you have to make decisions. You can't just use every horse that you think has a pulse. And so in those situations, if you bet a horse to win and the horse runs second and then you feel silly that you didn't have the place, well, don't just make that assumption that you were then wrong. Like, maybe that was the right play and you just got beat. Very often I make the right play and I get beat, and it's just part of it. And I'm never a big place guy anyways. I just think that, like, if you have an opinion strong enough to bet a horse to win, then you have a pretty good understanding of the race. At least you should have a good understanding of the race. And I think you're much better off playing the horse to win and then, you know, putting him in second in exactas, and eliminating horses that might not have a shot. I think you have a much better opportunity to kind of leverage that opinion. So, No, I don't think that was a mistake.
I think what you're saying makes sense, but it comes down to betting personality for me. I don't think it was a mistake to not bet place. I'm cynical about place for a lot of the reasons you've said. The only times I've ever liked place or done place consistently was when I was doing bankroll challenges as a public handicapper, because it was just the purposes of ease and doing public handicapping and having a horse on your watch list, and I wouldn't necessarily be able to grind for an hour on the race to do smart exactas. And when you come up with a price horse, especially, there was something nice. Even if I was getting back a little less than I thought I was on that place bet, it was still nice to just keep the bankroll moving forward. But in real life, I think it really just comes down to betting personality stuff. And I would say I don't come up with, and also to me, depends how often are you coming up with 25-1 shots? I feel like if you're coming up with 25-1 shots all the time, I get much more just leaving the favorite out in that example. But for me, this is where I would introduce the concept of the defensive use, where I'm not going to press the favorite I don't like, but I guess if I absolutely, like, detest the horse and I don't think he's even among the likely winners, if I think this favorite should be 8-1 or something, leave out. But if it's a 2-1 that should be 4-1 by my reckoning, that's where I'd get into the idea of a defensive use in the exacta, where, and Mike Maloney talks about this in Betting with an Edge, you just use that favorite like another horse. And you have some combinations, because I just don't come up with 25-1 shots that often. When I do, I want to cash, and you're still going to do okay because you've got that 25-1 shot to unlock the value to have the underlaid horse in the top spot there. What do you think of that strategy, JK?
Oh, I mean, that makes a ton of sense. You know, I'm not a huge exacta player anyways. And I'd like to consider myself, and this sounds, I don't think this is a pat on the back. I consider my style and I consider myself to be a shooter. Like, I can take 7 threes and miss all 7 of them. And when I take the 8th one, I honestly believe that it's going to go in. So I, it doesn't, I mean, don't get me wrong. I much prefer to hit the first three of the seven shots I made. That'll help me have more confidence and I'll play better the rest of the way. But I don't need to, cash every time I bet. I can handle getting beat. And so if you're one of those people that can't handle getting beat, then the place bet's great for you because it'll keep your brain where it needs to be. But for me, I'd rather just, you know, it's that whole idea of you're going to be wrong more than you're right in this game. So when you're right, you need to have all of your money in the right places to pay for all the times you were wrong. I feel like any money used in the place pool is going to help, is going to hinder my ability to be, to make all those other wrongs go away. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. But who's kidding who, JK? You're a stone cold front runner.
No, absolutely. I'm not as bad as Cam Newton, but I do prefer to be out on the front end.
I've seen you bounce back. I've seen it happen. But I do. I mean, examine your biggest tournament wins. Are they? Does that fit that you get off to a good start and improve your position, or have you had ones where you were down, you know, Mark Strife like down to the nub and come back with a puncher's chance and end up getting there? Is there a pattern for you?
I have never played in a contest where I've been on my last leg and then stormed back.
Be an interesting thing to work on, actually, almost just for practice. I think it would be a good club to have in the bag in some of these tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually at zero by the time that has to happen, you know?
I don't know if you've listened to the whole thing yet, but on the Breeders' Cup Plays show, and if folks haven't listened, I encourage them to check it out. I love to give JK a hard time. I find myself in the unenviable position of like being your biggest defender. I don't know what was going on, JK. You're not gonna even recognize your co-host in that show.
Benny was just trying to get after me, and you felt like you had to defend me. So
he's another candidate, by the way, for me to interview for next week's show. He'll be on one soon. It's the idea. I don't think I'm telling anything anybody doesn't know at this point, but throughout entertainment history, there's been a pattern of certain people whose public persona is sort of like a version of who they are, but not with the same name and with some details grafted on to make them more of a character. I'm talking about, these references, JK, these are old showbiz references that will probably fly right over your head, but Father Guido Sarducci, Don Novello, the man who essentially played Father Guido Sarducci, but you'd never see Don Novello on The Tonight Show. It would be Father Guido Sarducci. And I think about the comedian Dave Einstein, a.k.a. Super Dave, who, again, on talk shows, and you know him because he is from... He's from Curb. He played you'll know him if you see him. You're at your computer. Look up Dave Einstein and you'll know exactly who I mean. But anyway, for years on talk shows, he played this daredevil character, Super Dave. And then the other great example of it is Andy Kaufman and his alter ego, Tony Clifton. Well, that's the story clearly with Benny Southstreet. But the actual man who is largely the basis of Benny Southstreet has quite an interesting backstory himself, and I'm excited to get that told, and I think we might do that for the new book as well. So that could be fun. Did you look up Dave Einstein yet?
I know Dave for sure. Marty Funkhauser.
Funkhauser. I was trying to remember Funkhauser, and I couldn't come up with it.
My man passed away this year.
Yes. He's a real comic genius. And then, for those, I'm sure a lot of people listening know this, but his brother, Albert Brooks, another just amazing, amazing comedian. But anyway.
If you've never seen that show, if you've never seen Curb Your Enthusiasm, I would honestly say that people always talk about what shows are you watching? What shows do you like? Whatever. I would tell people that I honestly think that it's probably one of the greatest TV shows I've ever seen. And if you've never seen it, you should watch it.
It's brilliant, and it's been such an unbelievable influence to comedy, too. I feel like there's so much that's happened since it that owes it a major, major debt, both in the way that it's created, but also just sort of the vibe that it creates. Here's something you won't believe. There are episodes of it I haven't seen. I haven't seen every season. I still have, and I've been I do this once in a while with shows where I save them. So like, it's kind of nice for me that even now in 2019, I can sit down and watch a fresh season of Curb. And so I've still got like two or three seasons I haven't seen. So I'm going.
Do you know when I watched a majority of it?
When?
When I was in college. my last year at Texas, I only had like 6 hours, or I can't remember what it was. So I got like signed up to be a substitute teacher. And so I would take these substitute teacher jobs, and I would oh, this is so terrible. I would bring my laptop with Curb Your Enthusiasm on it, right?
Oh my
and I would
God.
Get to the class, and the teachers would sometimes, you know how teachers leave busy work, right? They just leave like, hey, have them do this worksheet or just like whatever. So I would give them all their stuff, and I would say, look, I don't care what you guys do. Just don't leave the room and open up your books to page 47. And if someone comes in here, be quiet. You don't mess with me. I won't mess with you. And I would just sit there and watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I watched from start to finish, oh like all God. Like 9 seasons.
That is fantastic. Oh my goodness. That is that is some pro substitute teaching stuff. You know, my mom still subs. I'm going to suggest that to her. We'll see if that, you know, she's got the little kids, so I'm not sure she can get away with it, but it's a very,
I only did middle school and high school. And most people are scared of high school kids, but I was like 23. I could care less, right? Like they weren't going to mess with me, and I wasn't going to mess with them.
Oh, so. My goodness. That is tremendous stuff. I'm extremely happy that we went down that very, very deep rabbit hole. Hopefully listeners don't mind. Speaking of Benny, this is a question that was actually directed at him, but I think it's a really good one to talk about. What is the most misunderstood trouble trip note? I'll let you take a swing first.
I think the most overrated trouble is trouble that we saw on the artist formerly known as Noose was inside trip shuffled. I think that's the most overrated one, because if you're saving ground on the first turn, you're saving ground on the second turn, you get shuffled and lose a length or so. Yes, it matters. Don't get me wrong. I just don't think it matters as much as people think it is, because everyone sees it. So it's baked into the price. That's the first part.
Yes.
And the second thing is that, yes, you lost a link, but the horse on the outside that was 3 wide on both turns that beat you, he lost 3 lengths. So it didn't really make a difference about you winning. And so I think that's the most overrated one. And like I said, mostly because everyone sees it. Everyone sees the horse on the inside from the pan view get shuffled. Everyone sees it. So I think that's probably the most overrated.
Benny basically agreed. He went with steadied. He says, unless you watch and decide for yourself, the steady often happens because the horse is being outrun. And then he mentions that on the flip side, he feels like simple comments often get overlooked that can be meaningful. And he mentions both dueled and between. Points out that you still need to watch, but those are usually passed over and important. I think that's good. Reading this makes me want to get him. I don't know. He hasn't written for the blog in forever. He's too busy bashing you on podcasts, JK. But the guy's actually pretty sharp. We got to get him back on there. How about the flip side of the question for you? Underrated trouble.
I think middle moves.
Yeah. They're not always noted in the chart comment or whatever, but
yeah, so
to me, that's a great one you can make for yourself. The visual middle move that's not necessarily going to end up in the chart. I like that one.
I think that answer is actually probably I like that answer, but I want the question to be different. What's the most not underrated, but like what's the most valuable trip note? And I think it's middle move. I think people don't see it. It's not baked into the price. It's very misunderstood. It looks like a horse can middle move going 2 turns, and then people don't think the horse wants to go 2 turns.
Right. That's a great point. And especially when the pace is fast. The classic buyer angle that I mentioned 7,000 times on this show and also all the time over on At the Races, the idea of the move that gets made into the hot pace. People make way too much of it. Oh, he spit the bit. He doesn't have character. He doesn't want to go that far. No, he just ran inefficiently. And I also like the nominating of between, that idea of the critical stage in the race where the horse isn't able to accelerate. To me, that's huge and often very, very underrated when it comes to this stuff. And then also just the idea, a misunderstood thing in trip notes to me, and I feel like a lot of trip handicappers have gotten better about this, but the idea that you'll hear some pundits criticizing push-button horses who make their own trips, wanting to bet against them because they have a perfect trip. And to me, that is just one of the bigger mistakes you can make, because some horses can create their own trip, and they don't. That is a skill. You shouldn't be penalized for that. Do you agree?
100%. And the other thing about it is that a good horse's perfect trip can be a bad trip for an unruly horse, right? So if a good horse gets a pocket trip where he sits right down inside, right behind the leader, shuts off, relaxes, and when the rider says there's a crease, let's go, and pops through, then that same trip for unruly, green runoff types is an awful trip, right? Because they're down in there, they're fighting, they're throwing their head, they're mad. When the rider asks them, then they've wasted all their energy, they're not there. So you don't want to criticize a good horse for getting a good trip. And that's why he's a good horse.
And right. I mean, you make such a good point about the differences in horses. The plotter who steadies, some horses create their own bad trip, and you don't. And I used to make the mistake of falling in love with them all the time too. It's hard. It's something I still fall prey to from time to time, but you've got to look at the individual and what type of athlete they are and try to understand what is that trouble a byproduct of. I don't want to upgrade the horse that breaks off slow a length every time, because some horses just break slow every time. At some point, unless there's some pressing reason, a new barn, a new training regimen, a change in the workout pattern, I'm going to expect if they don't break well, they're going to continue to not break well, and there's no reason to update them when you're creating your concept in your mind of what their ability is. I think one more, and then we'll go to look at this Saturday Del Mar late pick four, and this is an interesting one, and I think we've talked about it before, but it's a good one to bring up from time to time. How do you deal with a losing streak at the windows, JK? What are your strategies for bouncing back?
Yeah, I mean, those things don't really get to me. I just, you just got to believe in the process, believe in what it is you're doing, and try to learn from the mistakes and dust yourself off when you get beat. I don't do anything different. I don't scale back. I just don't do any of that. I might think or maybe take a day off or whatever, if I have five bad beats in a row and there's a phenomenal opportunity on day six, I'm playing the phenomenal opportunity on day six. I don't really care about the first 5 days. So I don't really do anything different. Maybe that's to a fault, but I think about it. I try to learn from my mistakes. I try not to repeat mistakes, but I don't have a system in place. I guess I would recommend to people, if you're playing a bunch of pick fours and pick fives and you're missing, then start playing doubles and pick threes. It's something that, I've done from time to time, but it's not so much because I'm going bad. It's just so much because, the fives and the fours aren't working. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm going to try to find something that is.
I think you're a bit of a unicorn, honestly. I would not tell anybody listening. I'm not saying that answer is wrong for you, and I wouldn't tell you to do anything differently for you. But I think that if that was your, and you were, to be fair, answering what you do, but I would not make that advice to people. Honestly, I think that could get people in a lot of trouble, because it can be such a difficult game mentally. And my advice is simple, and it's obvious, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway. I think taking a break makes sense. I think cutting back stakes makes sense. I think part of having a bankroll that's dedicated to this makes this a lot easier. You know, if your cold streak means your bankroll's gone, you start a new bankroll and you make bets that are relative to the size of the new bankroll. And then the thing that you said at the end, JK, I think is critical. Simplify. Take the level of difficulty down a notch. If you're playing on a limited bankroll, if you've been losing, you don't want pick fives and pick sixes to me. You want exactas and doubles and win bets. And you get your confidence back. And again, Mike Maloney, anytime we're talking betting strategy, I'm liable to quote Mike Maloney six times. You earn the right to bet more. For me, that's how I've always done it. And it seems to work pretty well for me. I'm much more of a simple bettor. I bet a lot more win than most people. And so maybe that's part of why this strategy works for me. And when I have slumps, it typically is because I'm trying to hit home runs. And when I get back and just try to square up the ball and make solid contact, I haven't had the slump that I haven't been able to get out of yet. Knock, knock. I've had some bad ones, but things have been going okay lately. Hopefully we'll keep them in the right direction. And I think it's very smart to just the mental, those breaks are just for most people just so important mentally, I think. But again, all this stuff gets down to personality. You need to do what you think is going to suit you. Anything else on that, or should we talk Delmar?
Delmar it is.
Let's do it. Saturday, November 23rd, the late pick four starts with race number six. It goes at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. local time. I will not be there yet. I think I will be landing in an aeroplane around this time. Maybe I'll even, I don't know. I don't know the flight path. Maybe I'll even see Del Mar from above. But who knows? Maybe we'll like these races so much, JK, that I'll play a pick four and root from the sky. How are we going to get things kicked off in this two-year-old maiden going six furlongs on the dirt?
Well, I think the story has to start with Garth showing up here, the Into Mischief colt, the two-year-old for Bob Baffert, who debuted, I was somewhere at Saratoga when I saw the horse get beat after I had
I think you were on air.
Fives. Right, probably.
Yeah, I think you were on air because we were up in the DG lounge and it was one of those, you know, my it's very cynical and I hope it never comes off too badly to various partners. But when I make a large wager that's one and done, well, that was fun. Garth was a classic. That was fun.
Yeah, Garth is one that back, I think it was in the middle of July, a two-year-old debuted for Bob Baffert named Eight Rings, who went on to win a grade one and was the second choice in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. And Garth outworked Eight Rings that day and continued to work with Eight Rings and hold his own. So when Garth ran, everyone was like, oh, this horse is going to be legit. Well, Garth got beat that day by a horse by the name of Storm the Court.
Funny.
Who went on to win the Breeders' Cup Juvenile at a huge price.
I hadn't remembered that.
Garth ran horrible against in the Del Mar Futurity when Eight Rings lost the rider and Nucky won. So here's the thing. Either Garth is just ruined and he's not a good horse anymore, or whatever was going on with him that kind of slowed down his progress to being a winner and not really living up to the hype, it's either going to change come Saturday or it's going to be all the same. I'm going to guess with Baffert taking the blinkers off, him showing back up. I mean, to me, Baffert would just give the horse a break if he needed a break. If he had issues, he would just give him time and not try to rush him back. But the horse has worked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times since his last race. I think Garth is sitting on a big race, and there's nothing else in here that really grabs me by the throat and yells, you need to wager on me. So Garth, for me, if I was looking for an alternative, it would be Candy Fury, but I don't like Down Inside where that one's drawn.
You had to think about it there for a second before you said throat, didn't you? My other point on Garth would be I can't see Baffert embarrassing Godolphin after the last day to bring him back in a maiden where he wasn't ready. It's now or never time, I would say, for Garth.
I would think so, too. And then, obviously, there has to be a conversation about the homebred on the rail, Ancient Warrior, for Jerry Hollendorf. It's a constitution. If you listen to any of these shows, especially the In the Ring Pedigree podcast, you're aware of the hot start the constitution's off to. So anytime you see one by constitution, it should grab your attention. The rail is definitely problematic, but the fact that they got Pratt and Hollendorf, that's one you might want to check out the workout report for. If there's some B pluses there, you might want to think about that one as well.
You've been playing more Del Mar than me. Is this been a Del Mar track where the rail is bad and the other paths seem equal? Has this been a Del Mar track where the further outside you are, the better? Has this been one where there's kickback issues and you want to be forward but clear in terms of kickback? How would you describe it?
I mean, I think it's fair to say if you're running on dirt in North America, there is an increased probability that the rail is not good. It's just kind of a trend that seems to be kind of going on everywhere. So I think always erring on the side of you don't want to be down there is smart until something else pops up. Now, I don't think I would run around just tossing rail horses. I'm just saying that, you know, you should be aware that being down there is not ideal. And it's been the same. It's been the same at Del Mar to a certain extent.
All right, let's talk about race number 7, 3-year-old allowance going a mile on the turf. Where'd you land?
I thought this was a tough race. The first thing I do when I'm looking at turf races in California, or excuse me, at Del Mar, is I look to see who's run well at Del Mar. It's kind of got that quote-unquote paperclip configuration where the turns are a little bit tighter. I think that you move at different times on this turf course than you might do elsewhere. And so the two horse Regeca, is that what we went with?
I like that.
Okay. I think that horse has run at Del Mar 5 times, 3 times has been in the money, one time. So that was one that caught my attention. And then also Hartel for Peter Miller, 4 times at Del Mar, 1 time winning, 2 times running second. So obviously doesn't have a problem with the configuration. And the other issue is that Peter Miller's been pretty hot. You know, he's 22%. At Del Mar for the meet so far, but he was like 40-something% at Churchill. So he's got everything kind of going in the right direction. So Hartel was the one that kind of grabbed my attention. I'm a little bit concerned that the horse probably won't run because he ran on November 15th, but there's an opportunity obviously for that one to run back off short rest. I wouldn't be shocked for Peter Miller to run a horse back that quick, but there's always the opportunity that he got in and he won't be running in here. So Hartel, if he's in, skeptical if he will or not, but Regeca was the one that I thought was the most interesting. In pick four situations, I'm going to use as many as I can in here, though. These turf races, I find myself spreading a little bit more than usual. So I think I would spread in this one as well.
Who would some of your long shots be?
Not so much long shots. I don't have morning lines yet. I thought Never Easy had a fast figure last time for Richard Mandela. So that's one, that you'd want to be aware of. One Flew South, stretching out, you know, was going 5.5 last time. You know, I think that sometimes if those horses can use that little 5 furlong burst at the right time of some of these turf races, they can really get themselves into position. And then Appreciated was another one that I thought was interesting for, I think it was Rafael Becerra who seems to be working well and is another one of those that's stretching out going from the 5.5 to the 2-turn situation. So it's one that I thought could run well as well.
Let's move on to race number 8. It's the feature, the Grade 3 Native Diver, mile and an eighth on the dirt, and the return to the races of Roadster. What do you make of this one, JK? Will the silver wig be in effect?
Yeah, I think so. Roadster ran well on Breeders' Cup weekend in the Damascus. He got beat by Flagstaff, who's obviously a really nice, talented horse. But remember, Roadster was one of Baffert's. He was his kind of next freaky one, and he had some issues. Didn't run that well in Del Mar Futurity. Had to have the throat operation because he had some issues. Didn't run well in the Derby. But then he's come back in his last 2 starts and ran well enough. He got beat by
Mucho Gusto.
He got beat by Mucho Gusto, but he was wide all the way around there. Then he comes back off a significant layoff and runs a lifetime best number against a really good field on a Breeders' Cup undercard. Now he's going to be stretching back out. I think he's going to be extremely tough in here. The only horse that I think can beat him is Extra Hope, who was right behind him at St. Anita. But Roadster for me with the silver wig, I think he's going to be tough.
I was going to take a little shot with Extra Hope against him, but you're making me think twice. I guess it'll depend on how the tickets get configured, but Extra Hope does look nice and progressive to me for Sam Siegel and Richard Mandela. Let's go on to race number 9, Maiden Claimers on the Turf, mile and a 16th. The question I always like to ask, how are we getting paid?
Yeah, you know, these are tough, right? Because these are the types of races where I don't, it's hard to tell what the intentions are, you know, like for instance, with 5-Star Lynch, are they dropping to win? Is this what this one deserves? Have they realized that maybe 5-Star Lynch just doesn't want to pass horses and it doesn't matter if he's running by you and I in a horse suit, he's not going to pass. Like, I just don't know, but based on the figures, based on the races that one's been running in, he was never really bet in those races. But I think, you know, 5-Star Lynch is one that kind of caught my attention because that's the first thing I look at in these maiden claimers is who's been running well in maiden special weights. And he was one that caught my attention. And then the other one was Friendly Out the Door. Or is that what it is? Out the Door? Other Door? Friendly out the door. That's right, right?
Friendly out the door.
They couldn't give me another O?
I didn't make it too easy.
It was like Wheel of Fortune or something. They ran out of O's. I thought that horse ran well last time at Santa Anita. You know, seventh that day, but got a nice figure against a better group. The last time he ran for a tag, he was very close, got beat a length. So I think that one made sense as well. I always default to the horses that have been running maiden special weights that are dropping in with some friends that might be a little bit easier to get by.
All right, that's all the time we have for this edition of the show. We've got another one to record that'll be going up tomorrow, the Naira Betts Players Podcast, where we'll dive into the late pick five from Aqueduct on Saturday. But I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I'll thank our sponsors, particularly Stats Racelands. We gave them some love today. 10 Strike Racing, looking forward to hopefully seeing Clay in a couple of weeks, and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, who make these shows so much fun to do. Reach out to us on Twitter with your hashtag AskITM questions. Should have plenty of time this winter to get to a bunch more. I know folks always like to hear about betting strategy. Ask away, and we will answer. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin, who I kind of forgot to thank for his contributions to this show, so we'll throw that in here as well. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. Hey, everybody. Just wanted to give a word for our latest partner, Stats Race Lens. This is a product that is definitely worth checking out. You can even get discounts if you use the promo code STATSITM. We're talking about customizable PPs with comprehensive research abilities, video replays, advanced search and notifications, access to stats true odds, handicapping angles, and back testing. That's what Scott Coles used to help him win the NHC this year, and he's talked about on this show. It's mobile and tablet friendly. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping, and make sure you use the promo code STATSITM. STATSITM.